This week, Bam Azizi of No Password joins us for an interview. In our articles for discussion, we talk about why not to brainstorm in groups, the real reason companies are so focused on the short term, how to break bad business habits. In the news, we discuss Barracuda Networks, Fishline, and more. All that on this edition of formerly Startup Now Business Security Weekly. This is Security Weekly, for security professionals by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show about security startups, how to secure your startup, and advice for security startups. It's Startup Security Weekly. I need it from the top. Brought to you by, make sure your team is prepared to fight off the latest cybersecurity threat. IT Pro TV is the resource to keep you and your IT team skills up to date. You can stream IT Pro TV's courses live and on demand worldwide, so there's no need to send staff to off-site training. Their team solution provides access to a supervisor portal for full control over your team's training schedule and group analytics. Go to itpro.tv/startup security and use the code SS30 to try it free for 7 days and receive 30% off your monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. To learn more about IT Pro TV's team solution, sign up for a free demo of their supervisor portal. Are you looking for a career where you can make a real difference? Accenture Security is looking for passionate, creative minds to tackle some of the biggest security threats facing us today. Innovative thinkers who want to outmaneuver cyber criminals. They're hiring specialists across the spectrum, from security strategy to cyber defense, digital identity, and application security, helping to deliver holistic solutions. If you want to use next-generation technologies and global resources to change the future of security, visit Accenture.com/security careers. Welcome, everyone, to episode 68 of the podcast formerly known as Startup Security Weekly.
So we need a symbol now. We have to have a symbol.
That's right. We're a symbol now. We're a symbol of Business Security Weekly. We're working on making that name change more official, but this being the first episode of this year, did I get that right? This is the first episode of now Business Security Weekly for 2018.
That's right.
And on the lines via Skype, of course, is none other than Michael Santor. Cangelo, Michael, welcome.
Thanks, man. I'm the cold beach hobo, sand hobo this week.
I'm cold here. It's cold today. It's going to like wind chill negative 25 tonight is the expected low here in Rhode Island.
So this is how you entice me back to the studio, right? You're like, look, I know it's going to be like in the 60s next week, Michael. So come back up. Remember what it's like to be in snow and cold.
I want you to come back here in the studio so we can cuddle and keep each other warm. That's really...
Well, if you just said that would have been easier.
How about that?
Done deal. Yeah.
Michael,
happy to do it.
I get a lot of requests, and I just got one today, and I wanted to make sure we covered it probably at the top of the show, not spend too much time on it. But people are like, what are those books you were talking about in episode 67? And what are those books you're talking about? And I think there's really three that we've come down to. So, Mike, if we want to remind our listeners on the three books that really changed my life, all three of these books in succession. Michael was instrumental in recommending these books. I'm not a big reader. I listen. and even then, like, I'm not a big, like, book person. I think it was, like, part of my ADD or whatever. Like, I could just never sit down and, not never, but rarely would I sit down and read a book. It's just part of my thing. So the books that I do read really have to keep my attention, and there are a select few, but Michael's recommended three, which really, I mean, essentially changed my life, Michael. You've changed my life, Michael, is what I'm saying.
So no bar. I guess that's why we're going to cuddle. Yeah, you know, keep in mind, too, these work in order. Paul and I had a great conversation about this yesterday and how they work. The first book's called Play Bigger. I got introduced to this by a client. The idea is that you can change the category you play in. So if you're in security today or you're a vendor and you're, but I don't know where I fit in the Gartner Magic Quadrant or I'm not sure how the industry sees me, Play Bigger says good. That's your advantage. Don't be defined by somebody else. Go define your own thing. And they hearken to, we've done user design, we've done system design, we've done all these other designs. You can design your own category. It's a great way of looking at it, and it's a lot of the stuff we talk about here in terms of falling in love with the problem. And that's where you'll hear us talk about that. And if you go back, we'll link to it. There was a great episode that we did with Matt Alderman where the three of us got a chance to talk about category design. And we've heard from some of you that that's actually been helpful to you. So you can look for more of that in the coming year. After you read that, and that's the one, you know, if that's just to be clear, if that's where you're at, you're in that vendor space, then you're going to want to spend some more time with it. And if you're listening right now, say, but Michael, hold on, we're just an enterprise security team, then absolutely read that. Because if chances are you already got categorized as the team of no, that team that doesn't help us, or I don't know why we would need to involve them, this is your chance. If you go read that stuff and you think about how you define the problem space differently and how you market yourself internally even, huge difference. And I've started to do this with some of the security leaders I work with, and they love the results. When you get done with that, next book is called The Brain Audit. It's written by Sean D'Souza. He's going to be on the program with us next month. And I've become a huge fan. Like it's what I love about it, just as a lead up to it, is he writes the book. And then he said, by the way, I've got all these other things. And he's pretty antithetical to the rest of the marketplace. This whole idea of you've got to have a funnel and you just churn people through the funnel and hopefully some percentage works out. His attitude is, how about I be really valuable to people, but I'll show you how this web unfolds itself and it all works out. And I'm a perfect example of it. He's very transparent about his approach, and I have bought almost all of the courses that he's made available to me so far. And there's one or two left, and I'm really looking forward to getting those. So what the Brain Audit does is it says, so category, right? Play Bigger is all about your category. How big is your category? Where are you going to go with it? When you get into the Brain Audit, what you're talking about is, who are you selling to? And he does something, it took me a little bit of time to get my head wrapped around it. We're going to talk to him about this. If you're in this, you'll talk a lot about personas or profiles. And his point is, it's one person, not three people, not 10 people, it's just one. Just who's the person? Otherwise, it gets too kind of convoluted. And I'll be fair, it took me a while to get my head around. Wow, the difference. And what he does is he takes you through the seven steps. So he's basically said, if you could pause the way people make decisions, there's seven steps that we go through. Let me explain them all to you. First three are attraction. Next four are how you overcome risk. This is so important. Again, if you're selling something, you really need to get a sense of this. But this is just as important. Again, internally, you're selling something.
Like yeah, you're selling a new idea, a new project, yeah. A new process. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and so it's the same thing. And then the third book, and this is the one that you and I have been talking about a lot lately, is Never Split the Difference. That's Chris Voss. And I'm optimistic we can get him on the program this year as well. Former FBI hostage negotiator. And he kind of chronicles his story of, this is how everybody thought negotiation worked. This is how it actually works. And let me talk to you about it. And so the way I look at it is, category design is, so where do you fit and what problems do you solve and do people understand it? Brain Audit picks up, first thing you have to do is better identify the problem. So if somebody has that problem, you've elevated it in their brain and they're interested to figure out if you can help them or not. Never Split the Difference to me then is that individual. Somebody says, okay, love, yeah, I have that problem and I think I like your solution. So how will we work together? So you're going from big category to, I want to go help people who are like this solve this problem, to Never Split the Difference, which is, how do you work with an individual to actually negotiate what's good for everybody? And he's got some things in there that I think people would say are counterintuitive until you start working with them. And then suddenly it's like, oh, it's really cool. And I'll say this too.
He says like something trigger. In the book that I think is interesting. And he says sometimes his students, right, because he's a former FBI international hostage negotiator, right? That was his former role, but he's been teaching business classes based on his experiences and the way he basically effectively redesigned the way you negotiate. And don't think of it as just negotiating. One of the things I took from it is he says, well, his students sometimes say, like, I feel like I'm cheating or I feel like I'm tricking people. And as you get further into the book, I've realized that it's more about honesty and being honest and labeling things that and putting them out there in the open. To the point, like, I feel better about talking to people in a sales capacity, in a purchasing or any kind of negotiation. I feel better because I'm being more honest. I'm just like getting it out there. I think that's one of the kind of underlying themes that I took from Never Split the Difference.
Yeah, no, as well said. And that's what one of the things that I liked about it, you know, because sometimes people are like, oh, I read the latest book on negotiation. Let me bust out these tactics. He's like, there's no tactics.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, if I summed it up, you have to tactically understand what's important to the other person. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they don't know what's important to them. The sooner you can help them figure out what's valuable to them, the better it works. So you'll see, this is why it works for a lot of the stuff that I do, because Straight Talk is all about how do we translate our value and understanding.
Yeah.
Well, all three of these things are all about the problems, all about ways that we make decisions around those problems, and all about ways we find out what's interesting to everybody else. So you got to imagine, as I was reading through these, in fact, I'm going to start the cycle again and read through them and start taking notes. I've been looking at different ways to, believe it or not, read books, and different types of reading, and whether you should read fast or slow, and how to take notes and do your marginalia and ways to do it differently. And so a bunch of you have asked, and we made that comment about doing a book club or whatever else. Yeah, we'll see. We've got so much great stuff happening that we're really excited about that's going to take me a while to execute on. Here's what I can promise you over the course of the next couple months. I'll do like a book report type of thing on these books, and I'll show you how it works in some of the stuff that we're doing. I'm not sure what the format on that looks like, but because I'm going to sit down and reread them, I'll put that to good use for us, especially as we expand our written program here on the network. So those are the three books. I have a couple others that let me get through them, mm-hmm. and I'll kind of figure out where they fit. There's a couple books that I think have been fantastic on the leadership front, and a couple that are pretty good on the sales front. And the thing that I've learned about sales is, it's funny, Paul, when I was a younger man, back in the 90s, I remember I was still, so one of our partners, Accenture, I was with Accenture, and I didn't sit down fast enough and got nominated to go to some meeting or whatever. I was the youngest person in the room, and all I can remember is somebody coming out to me afterwards and saying, I'm kind of impressed that you figured it out. And I had no clue what they were talking about, and I said, yeah. And thankfully, he continued. He's like, you figured out that it's about sales. Security is ultimately about sales. And I was like, oh, yeah, right. And so everywhere I've ever worked, I've always tried to support the sales team or work with the sales team. And it's frankly, it's been like a 15-year journey of really trying to understand sales. And in the last year or two, it started to click. And now that I go work with security leaders, there's just some fundamentals of sales that if you understand the basics of marketing, the basics of sales, you will be a better leader, but you'll run a better security team. I guarantee it. And so this stuff is going to be really important. So however you're joining us, whatever your interest is and whether you're trying to improve the security of business or improve the business of your security, these are good books, and we'll keep looking for some more as the year goes on. So
excellent. That's what we got. Make sure to check out our friends at itpro.tv. Use the code SECWEEKLY. Try it free for 7 days and get 30% off if you basically want to be an awesome IT leader and learn about stuff. Go to itpro.tv/securityweekly. It's awesome. You should do that.
Well, yeah, let me just make a point on that too, because they're a great partner to us, and I've been really impressed with their quality. But what I'm also impressed with is when I talk to them at a business level, I really enjoy their vision. I enjoy the way that they're executing on it. And so I think a lot of people who are more technical look at it and go, oh, that'd be great for me. I mean, Paul, we've got fantastic stories of our audience using their stuff to prepare for new positions, using their stuff to prepare for certifications. I think what sometimes gets overlooked when you're a leader is, and this is going to be in one of our stories today, you really need to focus on training and development. Oh, and by the way, don't ignore yourself. Some of the stuff that they've got there is great. If you want to stay current, keep your pulse on it. During one of the calls this week, Paul and I made a joke about how he still pines for the command line, and I don't. Mm-hmm. I remember the transition about maybe a decade ago where I thought I could do both well. And for me, I had somebody sit me down and say, Michael, you have to choose. And I chose. It wasn't a hard choice for me. Paul, you may not have to choose, but
what I find
to
interesting
keep
too.
Rest the stuff. That's our partner's a great way to do it.
And there's a lot of places to get training, specifically in IT and even security. And we've taken briefings and we've tested out a number of training platforms
over the
past 20 or so years, and even recently, just meeting with a bunch of companies trying to figure out what they're all about. And I want to say, they chose us as much as we've chosen them, and we choose to work with the SANS Institute and ITPro.tv because we believe in them as organizations, as companies, and we believe in their products. And I think there probably is no more resounding endorsement from us. Don't just think we happen to stumble across them. No, like they're vetted. We ask other people for their opinions on them, and I'm just happy to be able to recommend to our listeners, that quality training to kind of save you the trouble from having to go, you know, find out where quality training is, like, really, those are the two places we've chosen. So choose them as well.
Yeah, I think that's well said. That's absolutely well said. How do you feel about passwords, Paul?
I hate passwords. You know what? I hate the entire authentication process. I really do. And I tried to simplify it throughout my life in various different ways, most of which have failed. Due to the value that I put on many of my services and accounts, I, you know, go the extra mile as often as I can, which often means I have to sacrifice some convenience. I think we had the conversation about YubiKey. Love YubiKey, but I often find myself going, I'm downstairs in my office and my YubiKey is up two flights of stairs on the second floor in the same room where my wife is sleeping. Crap, this sucks. And right. So I think we're all looking for better solutions. To talk about some of those solutions, Bam Azizi from No Password is joining us today. Bam, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So Bam, we've already kind of described some of the problems that we have, you know, with passwords and authentication. How do you define the problem, and what's your take and point of view on the password problem?
So I'm sure everybody knows the password problem. You don't need to have expertise to know what's the issue. But two main problems are one is the inconvenience, as you mentioned, and second is the security. Password has been around for 40, 50 years, and it doesn't cover the modern needs of authentications, especially when it comes to new users' behavior on smartphones. Everybody's carrying smartphones. They don't like use laptops or desktop as they have used to basically use it previously in like last decades. So, and in the smartphones, you need to, for finding the special characters, you need to do like keyboard gymnastic to find all those characters to cover your complex passwords. And often people use like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 to fix that problem, which is not a good solution.
Well, yeah. So let's talk about this for a second, because you said something I think is interesting, and it's the proliferation of mobile devices. Has that really started to change this? Like, are we finding that? Because I mean, passwords aren't new; they're centuries, they're millennia old. And to be fair, they're not going to go away. So when we say we've got a password problem, what we're really saying is modern use of our devices requires a different way of authenticating. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. So what I was trying to say is definitely passwords are not good in any form and in any use cases. But when it comes to smartphones, people tend to hate passwords more because it's harder to type and harder to change. And there are some other ways to prevent that. But in general, yeah, that's the statement I was trying to make.
All right. Well, so, just an example that comes to mind is with a Wi-Fi password, for example. And when we talk about the Internet of Things, not just smartphones, but if you've ever tried to enter a long, complex password for your Wi-Fi network on your thermostat specifically.
Yeah.
And then there's lots of other devices. I think the Nest thermostat's a good example. Like there's the dial and then you have to push and then there's other, like it's even worse on a thermostat than it is on a phone. And it's just it's super annoying.
Well, yeah. And I'm one of those people that has like those auto-generated 32 character passwords. So trying to authenticate on your Apple TV, same thing, like at least the older versions. Oh man, so I get it. So it's a pain, and so instead of suffering through the pain, Bam, what you're saying is most people just opt for poor passwords and poor password hygiene, and so as a result, you think that there's a better way. So what does the better way start to look like?
So just forget about like me and No Password for a second. So in the industry, people are trying to solve the password problem, and they just focus on the security part of it. So they invented like second factors or multi-factors that you get a OTP or a token or something that you need to enter on top of your password. And it means like less convenient, but we showed that again and again, it's not secure. So based on Ryzen last year report, 85% of SARP attacks are based on a stolen credential. Even the accounts that has been secured by second factors has been compromised in Google or other places. So we thought that the solution that we need to offer should be basically asking the user to not enter anything, because as soon as you ask the user to enter any password or any token, there is a chance of social engineering and phishing. It doesn't matter that how many times you ask the user to enter something, they can enter it in the wrong place and then it's too exploitable. So our solution is multi-factor authentication, but we call it H2MFA. It's a human and hidden multi-factor authentication, because we believe that multi-factor authentication doesn't mean we should bother user multiple times. From the user's perspective, they just do like one-time biometric authentication, but behind the scene, we do all those multi-factors in a hidden and invisible way.
So, Bam, is it behavior-based? Like, walk us, ourselves, and our listeners through how users would authenticate in your model. Give us an example.
Sure. So we are supporting different type of biometrics modules. We do face and voice and like fingerprint, as many people used to do that on their smartphone. So the way our solution works, that you need to install our application on your phone and you use that application to have access to any other applications on other devices. So basically, we turn your phone to a key or password to all of your applications. And to have access to our application, you need to authenticate based on fingerprint, face, or voice. Now we are going after a behavioral authentication, means that we are leveraging all the sensors you have on your smartphone to authenticate you without even you knowing that we are authenticating you. It means that you don't even need to do biometric authentication. So, but we are in the beginning of that journey. There are other companies are doing that as well. But it doesn't mean that you don't need to authenticate anymore. Sometimes based on the machine learning algorithm result that we get, it might bother you again. But in the most cases, because we know that you're in the right place, you have the right pattern, you have the right behavioral, we don't bother you to do the authentication. We just authenticate you behind the scene.
That's interesting. So at a fundamental level, it's almost like two things that you have, right? It's, I need to have the phone, and then that phone needs to recognize some kind of feature or biometric on me. So in that sense, there is a multi-factor aspect to it.
Correct. Yeah. That's why we call it hidden multi-factor, because user just sees once, but we do like multi-factor behind the scene.
And now, go ahead, Michael.
What? No, do yours, because mine was going to take us a little.
I was just going to ask, Bam, so the environmental aspect of it that replaces the need for like my fingerprint, if you know that I'm holding my phone in the same way in a location that I've been in before and I'm connected to a Wi-Fi network that I'm always connected to, you may say, well, I don't really need your fingerprint because I know that it's you and you're in your office by all of the other information I can collect from the phone about your environment, correct?
Correct. Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And also, we can claim that we can detect or authenticate you 99.99% based on your behavior. And wow. If there is any false result from our algorithm, we just ask you to do the authentication one more time. But 90% of the time, you don't need to authenticate even yourself. Your phone is on your pocket, and then you just have access to everything you want.
You know, it's interesting you say that. So I have another question, but it's interesting because I've started paying attention to the Apple, the iPhone 10 and the Face ID. And I've read some reports where people say, you know, when it works, it's amazing. Like you just pick up your phone and everything's there and I don't have to worry about it. Well, but it talks to that less friction approach that you're talking about. But I wanted to ask a more esoteric question, which is great because you're getting your PhD. So you're a smart person. Traditionally, right, we've always said, there are three factors for authentication: something you know, something you have, something you are. I like to say something you is, but that's probably not really funny to everybody else as it is to me. But when we start talking about, so I've seen in the past, people have suggested we needed to do things like location, or we needed to do other things. And you're talking about like hidden multi-factor or hidden human factors and stuff. Does that model no longer work? Because like we call it MFA now, but if you remember, we used to, if we go back 20 years, it was strong authentication meant you had any two. But just having two passwords didn't mean you had two factors. So then we called it two-factor authentication, and that's where we talked about the SMS tokens or the OTPs or some out-of-band thing. And then now we're calling it multi-factor authentication. So if we stop for a second, we just look at it a little bit academically. Are we at a place now, Bam, where we have more than three factors? Like, does location or behavior, does that become a different factor?
They are not different factors. They are part of your identity. So you can categorize them under something you are. So,
okay.
Like, get back to your example. So you said you have YubiKey, and YubiKey is something you have, like you hold it, and your password is something you know. And normally, second factor of MFA, as we call it in the industry, doesn't cover the biometric part of it yet. So it's just two of three. And the one that we are trying to eliminate is something you know, and we try to replace it with something your phone knows about you, instead of you entering something, because then that increases the chance of social engineering, because you cannot train all of your users. Definitely you have different type of users that are not tech savvy. They might enter their code or token in wrong places. And that is, by the way, the most common way of hacking that we know every day, breaking the news, right? So we try to change that model to something you are, which is your biometrics, and something you have, which is your phone, and something your phone knows about you, the registered phone, the trusted.
Yeah.
And then that would be the location, your behavioral. And also we generate a 2048 character password, one-time password behind the scenes, sending it to the server, verified on the server side. So that would be your password. That would be something you know, but actually you don't know it. Your phone knows it.
So when you add these other factors in then, are you basically just increasing confidence? Is that what's starting to happen?
Yeah, so psychologically, people used to use passwords, so when it's easy to have access, they just feel for a second, they feel not secure. But down the road, if they go and basically continue using the system, they understand that it's convenient and more secure. Normally, people start using no password. They try to test it. They ask their twins or their similar relatives to check if it works or not. And then they understand that it's very secure, and that people around them cannot leverage the physical access to the devices to basically steal their identity. And then they feel comfortable. So I think we need to educate people, and definitely Face ID or Touch IDs or fingerprints that we are using every day helps us to educate more people. And we are in the beginning of the journey. As you said, password has been there for like 100 years maybe, and we cannot change it overnight.
No, I mean, you raise a good point. You know, the thing that I'm kind of taking with too is that if we looked at trying to do behavioral analysis or any of these types of things 20 years ago, it sounded great, but we couldn't get enough details. We couldn't get enough data. But if we think about the proliferation of sensors, the data, the speed with which we can act on it, it sounds like we've made a lot of these things at least more possible than we've seen in the past. All right, so this has all been pretty interesting. I'm curious, how did you end up on this path? I mean, how did this turn into a company for you? And what's it like being the CEO of a startup company?
I'm CTO, by the way, but co-founder
CTO
of a
startup company.
Yeah. So what happened is we wanted to provide this and offer this to consumers first, because we had password problem, and I had a computer science degree, so I thought it's a good problem to tackle and solve it. And then we realized that it's very hard to sell such a product to consumers because they are not early adopter, first. And second is we don't have that much flexibility in terms of integration with different services. So we started to selling to enterprises because they were happier. They had like bigger problem, security really, they cared about security part of it, and they were happy to pay for such a solution. And we thought that, okay, we will provide a premium service to enterprises, and then when we grow up, we give it away for free to all the consumers, and then they can adopt the solution that has already been tested by big enterprises and banks and financial institutions. So, and then we ended up building a solution that fits inside the large enterprise's ecosystem. And so they can connect their VPN, their computers, workstations, and other resources or web apps, and their identity and access management ecosystem. They don't need to rip and replace anything. They just plug in no password and they take it from there. And then we provide the same service to consumers for free as a password manager, but they don't need to have any master password to manage all those passwords because there is no way that we can integrate with thousands of web apps that they don't have any type of integration like Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, or whatever. So everybody right now is using some sort of password manager or native browser password manager, which normally requires a master password to unlock your password vault. And we wanted to do that in a better way. So we have heard that, like, LastPass has been hacked and all the passwords got compromised. So what we wanted to do is storing all the information in your secure, basically partition of your smartphone. And we don't have any passwords from you in our server. So even if no password get hacked, there is nothing other than some sort of tokens and some information about your phone, but no real passwords is stored in our server. So I always say that in the forefront, you see that we are fighting passwords. But in the heart, we are fighting against centralized databases. I'm not going toward blockchain and other like complex stuff that you've heard about that. But what we want to do and what we want to offer is providing a secure way to store all of your passwords without using any master password. And you own your identity. You own your data. And you can destroy all of them whenever you want, and you are the only person that can unlock it and use it whenever you want. So that's our mission, and hopefully we will launch the consumer version, which will absolutely be free without any advertisement in Q1.
Bam, is using this system from no password, is there any increased exposure if my phone gets hacked if I'm using no password versus LastPass versus no password manager?
So we try to solve that problem. So there are many other companies that can make your phone secure, and because we are storing biometric information on your phone, we have zero tolerance about rooted devices and any debuggers attached to your phone or any like funky stuff that is happening. We have a self-destruct basically algorithm that destroy everything and smoke the phone. You can smoke the phone remotely. So if somebody steals your phone and you don't feel comfortable, you can remotely destroy all the information stored by no password. So we try to solve that problem.
Your biometrics and passwords are already, depending on what you're using, largely already stored on your phone. In hearing you describe it a little earlier, I don't really see any increased risk or exposures in using your system because someone does manage to get your phone. There are inherent dangers with that anyway, regardless of how, what mechanisms and various tactics you're using to authenticate to things.
Yeah, that is correct.
Michael, more questions?
What's your biggest surprise now that you're the co-founder and CTO, not CTO, CEO, but CTO of a company? I mean, like you've laid out a strategy that actually sounds kind of interesting, right? Enterprises will pay and consumers won't. But we also know if consumers start using it, I'm guessing then you've got a hook for the enterprises that have consumer facing activities, right, that they can streamline the whole process. I think it's great. Anytime you can create that kind of a demand and proof point, I really like it. So what's your biggest surprise been so far on this journey?
So there are some pushbacks that there are some hurdles that we need to pass. So we are talking with large financial institutions. It took like 2 years for us to close our first contract. And because we need to basically prove ourselves, we have done tons of testing and build a like very good product, but it has basically it needs to be tested, and it needs to be compliant with many other basically compliances, and we had to like gain different type of certificates. It took so long for us to close first deal, but right now, because we closed few deals, people are trusting us easier and easier. And I think it's just the industry start responding and reacting to what we are offering. And one interesting thing that we are trying to fight is the smart cards, because many enterprises using a smart card for their workstations. I don't know why they call it a smart card, because it's just a chip and pin and plastic. I get why we call it a smartphone, but I don't know why we call it a smart card. But we provided a solution that we tell them, okay, whatever you can do with a smart card, you definitely can do with a smartphone, because you have better storage, you have better security on your smartphone, and actually you can authenticate. So the smart card is passive, right? So if you have it, if you own it, you have it, right? So you can say, this is Johnny, or this is Bam. So there is no way that you can do the authentication on a smart card. And again, the other problem smart cards has is cannot address the modern needs. You cannot use a smart card for your smartphones. Your native smartphone applications doesn't accept the smart cards. It's very inconvenient. And then we have done a survey with one of our customers for their employees. They have 50,000 employees, and they asked their employees that if you forget your smart card that you're using to log into your workstation, and if you forget your key fob and your phone, which one you return to home and get it and come back to office? 90% said smartphones, and 10% said smart cards. Everybody, I would say, come back to get their smartphone, because we cannot live without our smartphones. And then they say, okay, that's a cheaper solution for our employees. And our employees, they are bringing their smartphone every day to the work. They don't need to replace it. And they are not dependent to external hardware. So they have it every time they are in the office. So it kind of makes sense for them to use that. But in the beginning, there are some pushbacks, because if you check, you know that like enterprises, they pay for a solution, they want to use it for 10 years. So it takes time to basically fight in the different divisions to change that behavior. And I believe we won't have the same problem for consumers, because consumers want just convenience, right? So if it's a convenient solution, they will use it. And if it has a better security, it's a jelly on top. So that's good. But we are 100% sure that we want to offer something that is more convenient than passwords for end users.
I got to tell you, Bam, you're one of the first persons. I mean, Paul joked, but I don't think it was a joke, that I am publicly in love with the password problem. And typically I just hear people bitch and lament and throw crap out there. That you've... This has been great. Like I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. I really like your approach and your take on it. Where can people get more information if they want to try it out, consumer or otherwise? Where do they go? NoPassword.com?
If they can go to NoPassword.com and go and add their email to the, like we have two sign up. One is for enterprise, free trial, and one is for consumer. because we haven't launched it yet. So we will add them to the mailing list and we will let them know whenever it's ready.
Awesome. Fantastic. Bam, thank you so much for appearing on Business Security Weekly.
Thanks for having me and Happy New Year.
You too. Thank you. With that, we'll take a short break, come back, talk about leadership, innovation, and startup success, as well as some startup news. Stay tuned. Do you have a website, an external presence, employees, an office? Any of these things can be compromised and attacked. How are you defending these assets? Have you penetration tested these public assets? Start 2017 by taking a proactive approach to securing your vulnerable areas. Black Hills Information Security has been helping companies find their weaknesses since 2008. Email consulting at blackhillsinfosec.com and see how they can help you sleep better at night. Welcome back, everyone, to Business Security Weekly. That's right. Couple of quick announcements. InfoSec World, March 19th through the 21st. Our listeners get 15% off using the code OS18-SW. Make sure you check Google search InfoSec World to get to, you'll find the registration there. All kinds of fun talks from really smart people. Make sure you check out our on-demand content, securityweekly.com/on-demand. There's 4 webcasts there. You can go get great information from content that we've done in conjunction with our sponsors, which is really awesome. Make sure 5 webcasts there now. Thank you. Also, Domain Tools is doing a webcast coming up. Michael's going to be on it. I'm going to be on it, and I'm going to poo-poo logs. Like logs are going to get the big poo-poo from me. So if you feel passionately that you get a lot out of your logs, come listen to this webcast and challenge me. securityweekly.com/domain tools. And then I believe it's Taylor from Domain Tools that'll show you how to use intelligence about IPs and domains to accomplish the same goals that you're trying to get out of logs and largely failing, in my opinion. So how's that for a description, Michael?
I liked it. I mean, it was well said. Yeah, I'm actually going to talk to them a little bit later today too, and go through some of the finer points with them. But there were a couple pieces in there I was kind of impressed by, and we're going to go through an actual attack and break it down and show you how to think about some of these things differently, which, to your point, it's not all about log files. The way I look at it is it takes something you know and let's pivot to something that maybe you don't know, but that gets you a lot more insights. And we're starting to see how people are using this to broad scale protect themselves because attackers are smart at some things, but they're not terribly efficient at other things. And if we understand and exploit that, I think we do a lot better. So it'll be fun. It'll be my first time getting to co-host a webinar with you. So 2018 is going to be full of firsts. It's going to be a good year.
That's it.
I'm excited about
what
it.
What do you got in our articles this week, Michael?
Well, you know, it's I feel like, just to be clear, I scan. I think last time I looked at my RSS reader, I get like 600 sources. But I find some of the best stuff keeps coming from some of the same people. So this is from Tomas again, and I swear this is another one. I've said it a couple times now. I'm going to have to just reach out and see if he'd be willing to jump on the show with us sometime. But it's interesting because the title is Managers Must Be Insane to Brainstorm in Groups. You know I'm going to read that. You know I'm just going on to it. But this is also equally interesting. There's a lot of science to back this up. There's been a lot of research and a lot of methods, and this is one they can replicate. When you brainstorm in a group, you get less ideas and they're not as good consistently. And it lays out why. So these are the things I get excited about. First one is production blocking. This is one I hadn't previously considered. So Paul, it turns out if you're brainstorming by yourself, your mind will work in parallel. You can work 2, 3, 4 ideas at the same time and kind of see where it goes. When you're as a group, can't do that. I mean, maybe you individually can, and maybe everybody else, but when you're brainstorming as a group, you all have to stay on task. And so you're single tasking it, which there are times it's really good, but for brainstorming, not so good. That was kind of a surprise to me. The other one's not so surprising. Evaluation apprehension and free riding. So the evaluation apprehension, and we've all seen this. Mm. In fact, this is the scenario, ready? Okay, we're going to brainstorm. There are no bad ideas, no criticisms. Just get the ideas out. Somebody goes, "What? Oh, that's stupid. Who thought of that idea? Oh my God, you always say that, right?" And so you get to the point where even if it's not that egregious, you're worried about what other people are going to think about you
yep.
or say about you, so you don't say something. And then the free riding is because you're worried about it, you're like, this is a good time for me to check my Clash of Clans, you know, mm-hmm. or I'm going to play a little solitaire, you know, whatever you're going to do. And so
yeah,
now
like
it does
someone
list
else
out,
will, it's the someone else will come up with a great idea kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, look, as an economist, like they use the whole, you know, some of the common problems and it's neat how they did it. Now, he has some advice in there, too, which is something we do in some of our workshops, which is if you let people prepare ahead of time, like there's some neat technology you can use now. So the idea is I let everybody brainstorm on their own. And then what I do is they brainstorm on their own and then I collect it up and I sanitize it. But the reality is, I'm not deeply worried about that because you can figure out who everybody is pretty quick. And you share it with everybody before you come together. So now I've taken away that whole production blocking problem mm-hmm. and the apprehension problem. You know what everybody else is going to say. And the free riding problem because you already did the work. And then you come together as a group and you kind of work through it. Now, that said, I don't always do that so much for brainstorming as I do for helping people identify challenges and work through things. But I just wanted to point out like this whole we got to brainstorm in groups. Yeah, no, you don't. But if you do want to come together to discuss stuff, just do the work ahead of time individually. Bring it together. You'll be a lot better off for it. Now, this next one is kind of interesting. Fast-growing startup teams built their sales team for long-term success. All right. I'm going to keep picking articles that have applicability. So if you're a startup, you need to pay attention to this. If you're a security person, you need to pay attention to this. You're a leader, you need to pay attention to this. You're a vendor in the space, you need to. I'm going to pick stuff that plays out for everybody. This was interesting to me, too, because it mentioned Splunk. So it used Splunk as an example, and it talked about how they made a lot of these decisions better so that they were able to do things really well. And you'll see that this fits with the next one, so it's why I kind of doubled up on two from Harvard this week. But what they talked about was, look, we all get this short-term thing. Do something now. I need results now. And they were talking about it from a sales perspective. But we see this in security all the time, too. I want it done now. I'm sorry I didn't invite you guys at the beginning, but I want it done now. Now. And so what they said was that they looked at there's three basic things you need to do and you need to really invest in to make a difference. The first one is recruiting. And this is what I thought was interesting. So we'll talk about the sales side of it for a second. They basically said, who are you targeting? And what they found with Splunk was they said, well, we went to our competitors or other people in the industry and we looked at the top performers and we wanted them. And I got to tell you, if you've ever worked with the sales teams, you know, it's let's not get into all the different ways of stack ranking and everything else, but there's always a couple performers that are just crushing it and they're doing really well. Well, so Splunk's point was, yeah, good. I want those people on my team. Okay. Well, saying that and going and getting them are two different things. And they kind of tease that out in this article. They basically said, if you do that, then what's your investment? What's the executive team's investment and what's your investment? You're not going to throw that up on LinkedIn and hope it works out. You're going to have to find them. You have to make sure that they're a good fit, and then you're going to have to actually attract them to you. By the way, Paul, doesn't that kind of work for us in security teams? I mean, if you're just going to go throw an ad up on LinkedIn like, hey, I'm hiring, do you think that works as well as I want some of the best performers? What's it going to take to get them on my team?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Right?
But you can't just
take
spray
an investment.
Well, much like marketing, you can't just spray and pray, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's like some of these things are not terribly surprising. It's not like, oh, we just unlocked the mystery of the world, but it requires a commitment. So saying that you want it, saying I want a high performer, well, great. I mean, in sales, I understand what that means. They're exceeding their quota. They're getting a certain amount. They've got certain levels of relationships. There's a number of ways to take a look at it. So how do we do that in security? So that's why I said, like, if you're looking at this as a security leader today, and I actually talked to a security leader today who said, you know, look, I've built a great team. But now that we're getting bigger and we're solving problems and we're building up a reputation, how do I retain those top folks and how do I attract new good people to the team? Yeah, great challenge. By the way, the fact as a security leader that you're thinking about that, that's awesome because you're going to start paying attention to it. That's going to make a total difference, which leads us into the second part, interviewing and hiring. This is something I've been around for 20 years. It's part what's just natural instinct for me, and part I'm just fascinated by it. It turns out, Paul, most times you'd be better off playing a game of darts. Like not with the – actually, you know what? You'd probably be better off playing a game of darts with the person you're hiring, and you know if they win, hire them. Mm-hmm. Most of the stuff that we do for hiring, it's got all sorts of biases, but it turns out most people don't know. I'll tell you why. We don't know what we're hiring for. well, Michael, I just told you it's sales, or I just told it's a security person. I don't even know what that means anymore. There's some other styles they introduced about, well, I got introduced to them about 20 years ago called CBI, critical behavior interviewing. Now the idea there, you actually understand the behaviors that you're expecting in a particular situation. And because you've identified the critical behaviors, then you have the ability to identify those behaviors in your candidates when you're going through the interview process. So a couple things in this. First, most people get it wrong because they don't do the appropriate amount of diligence on both sides or the appropriate amount of training. It works better. Like, it's a difference between like 50-50 and 80-20, which is a huge deal when you're hiring somebody. But what they talk about is we tend to like skimp this part. And it's like, oh, well, I'm in security and I talked to you and you seem like a good person. Okay, cool. You're hired. And they're saying, yeah, that doesn't get where you want to be. So again, what's your investment? Are you spending the time to figure out how this works? And what we're starting to see, and it had a good point in the article, some of these things are getting cheaper. Like, what does the application process look like? What are you testing for? You know, I had a conversation one time with a helicopter pilot in the military. And he told me that the application, the aptitude test for helicopter pilots, it was a joke. And I looked at him and I said, but it was a joke because you were selected, right? Like, wasn't that a bit of a selection mechanism for a helicopter pilot? And he kind of got this sly smile and he goes, yeah, I guess it was. That's interesting. So like, because we did stuff a certain way, I said, well, did it seem like the other people selected? He goes, all right, I see your point. It doesn't have to be super sophisticated, but do you know why you're doing the things you're doing? Do you know what you're looking for? Do you know how to assess them in people? I'm a big fan of like these trial periods and stuff. But remember, we covered this a couple weeks ago. I don't remember the episode offhand. I think it was Buffer said, okay, we've shifted it up a little bit. We still give people a trial, but we do certain things instantly. We on-ramp this way, whatever. Yeah, those are investments. How do we do that today for the most security teams? I mean, this was my greeting. Ready? Hey, welcome to the security team. Don't F it up, because when you do, the world's going to crash on your head. When you do a good job, whatever, dude. Get used to nobody paying attention. All right, well, don't screw up. Have a good day. That was my whole pep talk. That was my welcome to the security team talk, right? It's I think we can do better there. Last part's training and development. I mean, obviously, we've already talked about our partner, itpro.tv, but there are other ways to do training and development. What are you investing in your team, and what do they need to know? And what do you want them to know? And are you catering to their needs? That's how you're going to retain people, right? You know, I get it. We always look at money. And one of the things we think in our industry is that if we just paid people more money, they'd be happier. No, they'll keep jumping around. What keeps people? They like the leadership that they're working for. They feel that their voice is heard. And they feel that they're growing as a person. That their voice is heard extends into they believe in the purpose. That we're excited about the things that we're doing. And oh, by the way, I'm growing. I'm getting these opportunities to grow. So just, you know, you can do that to build up your sales team. So I think it's really important if you're in that role. But if you're just looking at building up your security team, these same principles absolutely apply. Anything here stand out? I gave it a pretty thorough covering, I guess.
Yeah, we're good. Next story.
Good job, Michael. I do a lot of prep on this stuff. Like I go back, I reread it, I try to think about some stuff on this. All right, well, so the real reasons companies are so focused on the short term. I don't think this is a terrible surprise for anybody. And so again, I looked at this one and it talked about, okay, well, if you want to change that problem, you've got to look at how you change the organization. And most of the way that the organizations change is they plead like, please, please, please take the long view, or they try to change incentives, right? So they muck with CEO pay or other types of things, and it's not really working out. So as I'm reading this, I'm going, oh man, this totally fits the way that we're looking at security leadership today. First one is beware the hidden cost of the outside leadership. And I paraphrase it, embrace the value of domain leadership. What they're suggesting here is what it really comes down to is what they've looked at is the role of R&D. Now, Paul, we cover this a lot on this program because one of the things that we've noticed is most organizations have essentially shifted R&D off their balance sheets. And that's what the startup ecosystem covers. And we've seen that no place more prevalent than security. What this article argues, I think fairly successfully, is the companies that continue to invest in the research, not so much development, but the research, they tend to do better. And it gave all sorts of stats on it. So what it said was, we like this idea of I'm going to bring somebody in from the outside. They're going to have fresh eyes and they're going to shake it up. They said, yeah, but that's got costs because those fresh eyes are going to see new problems. They're going to want a new system. You know, I've talked about this with some of our guests over the last year or so. What's the cost of rip and replace? I got to learn a new set of tools. I got new processes. I create new friction. I have all sorts of new stuff. And so I looked at that in terms of, do I always want to bring a CISO in from outside? No, maybe not. That domain knowledge, like not just do they know security, but do they know our business? Do they know our environment? That might be your bigger advantage. What do you think about that? Should, I mean, because, you know, we talked about it before. Let's stay on the security part. Do you think it's important for a CISO to have domain knowledge in security, or do they, or how deep, maybe, I guess, is a better question?
I think it largely, there are so many factors that play into that, Michael, in terms of what organization you're a CISO of, what your management style is, who you have on your team. I don't think there's a definitive answer for like what level of security knowledge a CISO needs, because I think it varies so too greatly from position to position, based on how your team is. I mean, there are, for example, larger enterprises that have very small security teams and do a lot of outsourcing. There are some enterprises that have very large security teams. If you have a really deep bench in your security team, you may not need to have as deep a knowledge if you have a team that you trust that can communicate, right? So I think it varies greatly.
Yeah, you know, I think it's well said. If you remember, we did a article a couple weeks ago too, where we talked about startups that have good technical expertise tend to do better than people who just have the business expertise. But what you really need is a blend of both. I kind of think the same thing applies here too. But so what I was pointing out was you need some sort of domain knowledge. I'm not sure it needs to be completely extensive, but we don't always need to hire from outside. Second thing is come up. Looks like I typed this wrong. It's think about re-centralizing instead of decentralizing. I thought this was really interesting in terms of both looking at research and development and looking at how we do stuff with security. The idea in research and development is don't decentralize it, centralize it, re-centralize it, bring it back together and give yourself that ability to, I'll use my phrasing, purposely cross-pollinate. I think that fits here too when it comes to security team, because I've looked at, you know, should we be centralized or decentralized or a hybrid model? And I think the answer is yes. And as we just said, I think it's nuanced based on the organization. But I'm starting to understand where, depending on how you approach it, having a centralized security team, if you've got the right relationships across the organization, I think it's a good play. And I just, looking at it in the context of research and development made sense. Let me make the next point, and then I want your take on it. It said emphasize research over development, and then it specifically talked about early stage technology. Here's why I started thinking about it, Paul. If we were able to better centralize some of the security team and some of those functions, but had good visibility and let's say penetration or relationships with the rest of the organization, and we got a better sense of the problems that they were trying to solve, broader than just security or, you know, I don't like passwords, then our teams could actually start looking at some of those early stage technologies, the types that we showcase on this program, and they could kick the tires and they could evaluate them and they could provide some summaries and some insights to the rest of the organization. And I thought, you know, that's actually kind of interesting. I think there's an angle here that your research and development doesn't so much need to be in-house big budget items as are you at least paying attention to early stage solutions to the problems that you face. So I thought that was kind of interesting as a way to get a little bit more longer term, but still make some pretty good short term plays. How do you think this translates out into security then? I mean, do you have a...
What you just described was when we did the interview with Jim Routh from Aetna.
Yeah.
It's exactly how... Were you on that interview? You might have been on
that. Yeah, it was a great interview.
Right?
Yeah.
That's exactly what Jim talked about. He's like, hey, we work with the other teams in the organization. We centralize. We bring people in and have a larger IT security and security team than most. And oh, by the way, we evaluate all kinds of new stuff all the time and do lots of research. So... I think that's a winning formula, certainly for Jim and his team at Aetna, that I believe it could be a model that lots of other organizations follow.
Yeah. So, you know, I feel like that might end up being a segment for us at some point looking at that. So those of you listening, if that's a model you've pursued and it hasn't worked, you pursued it, it's totally worked, whatever, you reach out to us, let us know. And you know, minimally, I'm happy to hop on the phone and chat with you about it. But let's see where we can go with that. All right, breaking bad business habits. So it's the same kind of a concept, but what was interesting about this? So this is taking a look at a book, and it opens up a pretty good story about. And it's funny because when I used to live outside of New York City, this was the thing, right? You got 2-3 papers delivered in the morning, and you sat on the train and you tried to figure out how to, you know, do the origami and get them folded so you could get to the right number of columns and read it, you know, without pissing everybody else off around you. And it said, okay, so somebody said, well, why? Why do they do it that way? Turns out it's traced back to a tax in the 1700s on a number of pages printed. So the way people got around it was they printed bigger pages. It's not cost effective. It's not even smart. Pissed everybody off. And so one of the newspapers tried an experiment where they said, all right, well, you buy it the regular way, or you can buy a smaller one. It's half the size. Set up for the way that you want it, and oh, lo and behold, it outsold it like 2-1 or 3-1. What it goes on to say then is, how many of these bad practices do you have in your organization, and you don't even know why they got started? And we've seen this in security all the time. Why do you do it that way? I don't know. It was that way when I got here. Okay. Well, why are you still doing it?
It's kind of funny when you just reminded me of a story when before my wife and I had kids, and there was such a thing as an actual paper that you would read, which I don't read today. It would drive her nuts because, like you said, you're like opening the paper and like rustling it and folding it, you know, trying to get to the point, and that would just annoy the crap out of her. Similarly, yeah, to the way that if I take my iced coffee and I swirl it around to get the coffee the cold clinking, and it makes that clinking, jiggling ice noise, that annoys the crap out of her as well. So if I had an iced coffee with the paper in the morning, oh, my wife would, like, wanted to stab me in the eye with a fork even more so than normal.
Well, you know, so it's interesting. So here's what I like is they, first of all, in the article, they're like, he spends the first third of the book falling in love with, or admiring the problem. I was like, yes,
yes.
Like, we need more of that. Fall in love with the problem publicly. Like, I like that. People think that that's a negative. It's not. It's such a positive. Now, the two things here I thought were really interesting. It said reverse benchmarking. So instead of saying, why are we doing it? Ask this really simple question. What would happen if we stopped?
Mm.
Don't worry about what everybody else is doing, what everybody else is thinking, or just go, if I stop doing this, what happens? By the way, I love that question. It fits into some of the stuff that we've done in some other places. So it's a great question to ask. And if the answer is, I don't know, I mean, right, long joke in security is if you don't know who owns the data, unplug the server, see who screams. And then always came with an asterisk of, by the way, that might end your career. I'm not saying do that. What I'm saying is ask the question, see if you can figure it out, because, man, we do a lot of just dumb stuff that doesn't make sense. And then the surprise it had, and this linked to another article, sometimes you should change just for the sake of change. Like the point is culture and organizational behavior is a never ending journey. Sometimes change just because you can, just because you should. Don't change because it makes sense. Don't change because the numbers added up. Don't change because you got to respond to something. Change. That felt counterintuitive to me. So I haven't read the follow-on yet. I grabbed it today during the prep to go through it a little bit more. But it's an interesting concept. Like, because if you think about it, Paul, right? You and I have come across people like, oh, I love change. I thrive on change. No, biologically, you don't. Biologically, we're wired to resist change. Nobody really thrives on it the way we all pretend. Some of us just do better at it than others. I used to pretend I was always really good at change. What I've realized in life is, yeah, I can be, but man, it costs me a lot of energy. Like, I'm good being a little bit more stable, at least as I got older. So I thought it was interesting. Any thoughts on that? Like changing just for the sake of changing?
I'm stuck on the next story, and now I have the song stuck in
more
my head.
More than a feeling. Yeah, hooked on a feeling. Yeah.
And then, for some reason, my brain went to hooked on a feeling. I don't know. Yeah. Is it more than a feeling? Are we hooked on a feeling? What is going on with this story, Michael?
It's our feeling episode. What caught me on this was it was about delivering business value. And then what they looked at was they said, all right, well, here's 10 design practices. And so what it goes into is this concept of design thinking. It is not a new concept. It got introduced in the 60s. And what it points out is some people get it right. Apple, Google, mm-hmm. Amazon. Some people get it wrong. That's a longer list. And it's something I've started to see pop up in security more and more, and I think we can learn from it. But what it basically points out is it's kind of like other things we've said today. It's not hand-waving, oh, we employ design thinking here. Really? What does that even mean? What they said, and the three things that I pulled out of it were design's not just a department, it's not just a function. And so one of the things that they go break these down. These are the three high levels. They were pretty good for me. it's more than a department. It's not just a function, but they talked about like embedding the teams or service. So it's go back up to the story we talked about, you know, should you decentralize? Should you go support other people? If the answer is yes, okay, well, same kind of concept here. Design's more than a phase. It's not a single phase you go through. There's a number of things you do, and you do them consistently. And if you do them well, you get better results. And then rely on evidence. It's not just it feels good, it looks good, I like it, like measure it. So especially when you're looking at design, right? Because we talked earlier about category design. So if you're looking at like UX, for example, user experience and the design of what that flow is going to be like, well, go measure it. Did people do what you thought they were going to do? And did they like it the way you thought they would like it? Don't just tell me, oh, they said it was good. They gave me a thumbs up.
I think that the ultimate in design, Michael, is if the person hates the company and hates the product, but still uses it because it has the greatest design. And I think there's so many people I know that have an Apple iPhone, and they hate the company. Like on the surface, they hate the company, they hate the product, but they still have the phone.
They're happy to get the next one. Yeah, that's right. A great point.
And they'll buy the next one when it comes out, even if they post on Twitter that it's so ugly, I hate it, but I bought one.
But it's awesome. Look at all these cool things I can do with it. Yeah, right. No, that makes sense. All right. So in terms of the startup and the news for the week. So as we transition to Business Security Weekly, we're still going to talk about startup news. Because if you're in the business side of security, it's important to know who's getting funded, who's making changes, who's advancing, how all those things are happening. So those things aren't going to change. This part's not going to change. We're going to add a segment at some point. And I know some of you have been asking us about lifestyle businesses. We got some good questions on some like how to evaluate vendors. We've got some questions around how to evaluate licensing schemes and stuff. So rest assured, we're putting that into the queue, and we're going to do some research on that and come back with a pretty thought out segment on some of those, as well as some other neat things that we're thinking about and getting planned, which is kind of also a light way to say it's lightweight week. It's first week of the year. Mm-hmm. I mean, other things, right? So officially, Optiv pulled the IPO, which no shocker, and officially Sky High is now part of McAfee, right? Those guys, like, that covered a lot of ink this week. Didn't matter, we already talked about those things. I'll just give those a mention. The big one for the week, Barracuda Networks acquired Fishline, undisclosed amount. Now what's cool about this is kind of twofold. We just talked about Barracuda going private based on Thoma Bravo, and we said, hey, pay attention. Like, there's a reason for this. Let's go see what they start acquiring and how they put it together. Well, they didn't delay, and they acquired Fishline. So as you know, Paul, we go look at this. I can't find any funding information for Fishline. What I mean by that is I don't think they took any money. So the undisclosed, sometimes undisclosed is like, oh, you're failing. It's not going anywhere. It's not going to work out. I don't have any insider knowledge in this one. My gut instinct is this was more of like a, oh, well, there's no investors to please or piss off. Well, screw them then. I'm not giving out that information. Which feels like a tactical advantage at the moment. There's an article we linked to where basically Barracuda goes into a little bit more, and they said, okay, so here's the deal. Like, we're going to start putting all these things together. And we believe that user education and looking at phishing and helping people is a big part of the experience. We wanted to fold it in. We liked the way they were doing it. So we'll see where it goes. Not a surprising move to me. Just the speed of it was kind of like, all right, they're on it, which doesn't shock me for even a second. That's it. That's our week.
It's an interesting space. The whole they lump Know Before, Fish Me, Fish Labs in with Fish Line.
And yeah, I think, that seems about right.
I think Know Before, Fish Me, and Fish Labs are the major players in that space. I feel like I'm missing someone.
Wombat plays in that space too.
Yeah, Wombat's in there as well. So I don't know. I the whole approach on the problem, I think, was interesting maybe 5 years ago. I think when we look at the solutions that are out there today, Michael, I see much smarter solutions that rely much less on the end user awareness and more on actually preventing those emails from getting in and, limiting the damage once they do get in. And I think that's a much better point of view of this problem than constantly trying to fish your users in an attempt to raise awareness and or educate them.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to surprise a lot of people that have known me for a while. And I've got friends at almost all of these companies, people I respect and admire very deeply. I've never really understood the whack-a-mole approach to phishing. And the question I've been asking for years is, but why can't we just do some of this technologically? I mean, so you mean that what we're going to do is take somebody who's already busy, stressed out. We know that they have an attention fatigue and attention residue problems. And we're going to say, aha, you just screwed up here. Watch this video. I'm going to make it better for you. And now hopefully you won't do it again. I appreciate people can show me evidence where that works. It's counterintuitive to me. And so people go, mm-hmm. but Michael, I thought you liked educating people. Love it.
Yeah.
By the way, the minute you call it awareness training and education, you suggest to me you don't understand any of them. Like awareness is not training, and awareness training, the whole thing. Like if you really break down the nomenclature and you understand it, and we've had this conversation with people on the program, I'm not against these things. I get phishing's a problem. I get wanting to give people clever, better delivered information they want in a way they can act on it. I just feel like, to your point, I don't think we've fallen in love with the problem properly. I think we've described symptoms and we've elevated symptoms and then said, boom, I'm the hammer. But that's not a nail. No, it's a nail. Look at it. Look at it again. It's a nail. I'm a hammer. The fact that Barracuda did this doesn't surprise me because people want this type of thing. Where I'd be really curious to see is there a unique delivery vehicle here? And can you give me insights and in education that I want when I want it, not just related to phishing? And please stop calling it user awareness training. Please, if you do anything this year, just user awareness, I'm good with. User training, I'm good with. But training and awareness are two different functions, period. Thank you. Thanks.
Agree. Well, thank you, Michael. And thank you, everyone, for listening and watching to this edition of Business Security Weekly. We'll see you next time.